Welcome. The Integration Aid Subcommittee will come to order. So thank you all for being here. First, I want to let everybody know why we're here. I think if most of you probably recall that at the towards the end of last session, we began meeting as an Integration Aid Subcommittee, and actually I'll be working closely with Senator Torres Ray, who was not able to be here today, but also she'll be joining me leading this subcommittee. And it is our charge to look at what it is that we are trying to accomplish with our integration aid, to really understand what this law is about, look at how we are currently spending the money, and look at what might be missing, what might be a way to restructure, or some policy recommendations going forward. So today, actually, while I appreciate that Gloria from the department is here, we're going to begin not with Gloria, but with Anne Marie, who's going to take us through the law so that people really understand what exactly the current law in the books is. The members of the subcommittee are Senator Phoebe is here, we appreciate. And the other members who are on the subcommittee but are not present today are Senator Roebling, Senator Hand, Senator Torres Ray, and myself. Senator Stump will also be joining us today as well. So, yes.
Madam Chair, members, then the sort of topic was integration revenue, but to there's a DSEG rule which sort of governs which districts will be participating in the integration revenue program. So through the DSEG rule and the integration revenue program, the question was, what are we trying to accomplish? And so the overarching goal for the rule is to have obviously equal educational opportunities for all students so they can succeed academically. But then some people think of when you have a DSEG plan or DSEG rule or integration revenue program that you can do maybe different assignments or things like that for school assignments based on race, and that's something that's not allowed under law for districts that are required to participate in the DSEG world, only if there is a finding of intentional segregation by the commissioner would there be some sort of student assignments based on race. So we have the plans under the DSEG rule where if a school is or the district is racially isolated or the school is racially identifiable, then they participate in the integration revenue program. They have to have a DSEG plan. They often have to work on a voluntary basis with surrounding districts and surrounding schools in order to provide what then is the goal of increased interracial interactions that enhance the learning opportunities for all the students. So it's supposed to enhance learning opportunities for the students that are part of the racially isolated school district or the racially identifiable school and the surrounding districts and other and those students as well. So with the plan, they can have part of the plan, it can be to increase their interracial context, can be like classroom experiences, they can be teacher, initiatives or staff development programs. They can also be cultural programming, classroom partnerships are an option, and summer programming and other kind of education-related programs, sometimes maybe through community ed, but it's up to the district and the participating districts to figure out their plan and what they want to do to increase the interracial interactions in their districts.
And can you tell us, is there anything in the law that refers to what school districts should accomplish as a result of the integration revenue?
Well, basically what they need to accomplish is the increased interracial interactions. So that's the goal. I mean, that's what they're trying to achieve through their plan.
And is there anything within the statute that refers to academic achievement within that interracial experience?
I think the end result is increased academic achievement from the increased interracial interactions, but there's not a measure of academic achievement that's required to be reached as a result.
Thank you. Does anybody else have any questions with regard to the specific statute? The other thing I might remind people is that during the session when the subcommittee met, we've already done a few things. We've had the state auditors, legislative auditors report. They came in and reviewed that report. We've also heard various testimonies from the integration districts. The three integration districts came and spoke to the subcommittee, and so if people need a refresher on any of those things, they should make sure and let us know. But let's assume that all that has happened and that that is part of the record of our going forward proceedings. So with that, we have asked the department to come before us today, and we've specifically asked the department to talk to us about what's currently happening with this integration revenue. Where is it going? How is it being used? We hear about the plans that the school districts are supposed to submit. What do those plans look like? What are those plans, implementations, results? What kind of results have been produced? So we'll have, I'm sure, several questions for you, but we appreciate you being here to do this presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Glory Kibble. I'm an education supervisor in the school choice area of school improvement. So I work with, the school choice programs, including the integration and desegregation programs. So again, thank you. I appreciate being able to be here. You have a packet in front of you, I promise. I will not go through it word for word. A lot of it is references. However, it is your homework for the weekend. Having been a former teacher, I thought I'd assign that right now, but I promise. It's
Thank
more
you.
Resources for you to...
Is there a penalty if we don't do our homework?
Well, I'll have to check with the commissioner on that.
Okay.
The history. And I took the history, I'm going to just kind of put it into, as you can see, just one slide. And this came from the legislative auditor report. But if I were just looking at the big overview of what's the history of the integration in Minnesota, in 1987, the legislature provided funding to assist the Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth school districts with their integration efforts. In 1997, the legislature created the Integration Revenue Program, which expanded integration funding and established eligibility criteria for school districts statewide. In fiscal year 2005, as we know, that was when the legislative auditor did their report, 80 school districts receiving approximately $79 million. They received about approximately $79 million for integration activities. Now, if you want more on the historical perspective, I have included, that would be the first piece of information on the left-hand side of your packet. I thought you might find it interesting. The first two, first couple pages is a report Lisa Larson did that she spoke to and presented at one of the integration hearings for the House. Again, I'm not going to go through it. It really provides more of a national perspective. And then behind that, you have a PowerPoint presentation that also has some national perspective and state perspective and drills down. But at this time, I'm just going to kind of leave you with this one statement about where we're at. And the integration program and the dollars are continuing to evolve, as I'll talk about in a minute. So what are some current statistics and facts, just so you get a statewide perspective of where we're at with the integration program? Currently, there are 116 districts that receive integration revenue. And if we break those down, 32 districts are defined as isolated. Isolated means that the percentage of their protected class is 20% higher than their neighboring districts. That's pretty much how it's defined. 17 districts are voluntary. If you're a district that doesn't have that percentage gap, but you want to participate with the district that does, then you can become a voluntary district. 17 of the 116 are voluntary. They don't have that the gap, but they're choosing to participate. One district has a racially identifiable school. That's Rosemont Apple Valley. The district itself is not identified, but there's a school that has a 20% differential between the school and the district for protected class of students. And then 66 districts are part of a consortium. So let me go back to the top. Of the 32 districts, let me use St. Paul. They're defined as isolated, and they are also part of a consortium. And in their consortium are districts like Monomedi and Stillwater. So that kind of gives you a broad view of the 116. And they're not all in the metro area. I think probably the one corridor that we're not, that we don't have a lot of districts in is up in the Bemidji area, because American Indian are not figured into the ratio for protected class. But Duluth, certainly down in southern Minnesota, and I do have a couple plans included in the information I'm going to give you from both Wilmer and Worthington. And so the central part of Minnesota, as well as kind of the southern corridor, has a lot of programs that are involved in the integration.
So, Ms. Kibble, you're saying that most regions or areas in the state, with the exception of the Bemidji area, are taking part in the integration aid program?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, yes. I wouldn't say. It would be interesting. I don't have a map here. I think that would be interesting. Certainly we can do one for you. But I would say primarily yes.
And Ms. Kibble, could you comment on the history around why the Native Americans aren't part of the protected class and why those statistics aren't figured in? And if there's somebody else who has that information, let us know too.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, I'd very much appreciate that. If somebody else would have that information, they can chime in. When the law was written and as it evolved, the American Indian population had other pieces in sight, including a law regarding parental involvement. And so the committee that looked at what the protected classes were felt that there was another program available for American Indian and did not include them.
Ms. Kibble, do you know if that program has funding associated with it on a per-pupil basis?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, to my knowledge, no. There's some grants, there's some success for the future, but no, there's not per-pupil funding.
Senator Folby.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Kibble. And do you know if that other piece is in place currently for the American Indian population?
Madam Chair.
Source of funding.
Members of the committee, yes, there is there's a Success for the Future. I believe 32 districts are part of the Success for the Future, but then there could be some overlap also between the Success for the Future and some of the integration districts. There is a parental piece that they have to have. There has to be a parental group. I'm not well versed to be able to tell you what kind of monies flow, but if you would like that, we can gather that information and let you know what kind of money the American Indian students, you know, do, what's generated.
Ms. Kibble, it does appear that Senator Folby would like that information. And also, are you in your presentation going to be talking about the difference between how much various districts get as a part of the integration aid program?
Madam Chair, I did not plan to put that in here, but we can certainly get that. We can gather that information.
Thank you.
The statewide perspective, but no, I don't have the district perspective.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, we'll be pleased to get that for you. Seven of the districts of the 116 were new and added for FY 2000. Oh, that's a little typo. It should be 2010 instead of 2209. So. But seven new districts were added for this for 2009-2010. And then with the asterisk, it talks about how districts qualify. Again, the district can be isolated, the school can be isolated, or the district can be voluntary. So those are the three primary ways. The purpose of the program, and it was pretty much outlined in the beginning, with the exception that last year they added closing the achievement gap. So there has been language about looking at the integration dollars, when we look at their budgets, there will have to be indications in there as to how they're going to close the achievement gap. And again, for your convenience, I've added The second piece on the left-hand side is I've added the copy of the statute, and then I've also added the 2010 and 11 biennial budget, the report, which gives you, again, some general information about the integration program that I won't go through here, but I may highlight a piece of it a little later. But again, it's for your information. So the appropriation, where I didn't break it down by districts or how much the districts could receive, it is 70% state aid, and 30% levy. And you can see the figures there for yourself, $62 million approximately in state aid, and $27 million is levy dollars. So the oversight of the money and how is it spent? It kind of goes from the plan to the budget to the money, and I'll walk through each of those three pieces. Integration plans are submitted to MDE Integration Office, and every 3 years, districts with a racially identified school site have to submit a plan. That would be like the example I used previously with Rosemont Apple Valley. If they're part of a multi-district collaborative, they have to submit it every 4 years. So they only have to, again, submit the plan every 3 or 4 years, depending on which of those categories that they fall into. The next piece in your packet on the left, in yellow, green, and kind of a pink, are actually three different plans. And the copies of the plans that I've included for you are Rosemont Apple Valley Egan, Wilmer, which is part of the West Central Integration Collaborative, and Worthington, which is part of the Noble County Schools. And when I talk about the collaborative or schools, it's that there's more than one school in each of those, in those collaboratives. The Minnesota Department of Education does not
have... Excuse me, Ms. Kibble. Can we take some time to talk about the plans?
Absolutely.
Okay, very good. And also, before we do that, when the school district submits a plan, so for example, suppose a school district is submitting a plan because they have one racially isolated school, and their plan is accepted. Is the formula then figured out on a per pupil basis for every student in the district, even though it's only one school in the district that caused them to submit the plan?
Madam Chair, that's correct. I can't tell you what that figure is, but it is a per pupil, even though it's only one school. That is correct.
But per pupil across whole district?
Yeah, for the total number of students, yes.
Okay. So let's see. The plans that we have are the... So could you just take, just give us an overview of one of the plans?
Let's look at the first one. Let's look at the Rosemont Apple Valley Egan plan, which is the yellow plan, the yellow copy. The first 7 pages is information on their collaborative council, information on how they got to the actual goals that they set. So I'm not going to go through that. The whole crux of the plan is if you go to go to page 8 with the actual plan. So let's walk through the first one. Increase racial balance within the district. So their intent in Rosemont Apple Valley Egan is they had one school that had a much higher population of protected students than other schools in that district. And what they wanted to do was help move some of the protected students out of that school into other schools, and also bring some of the schools the students from the other schools into Cedar Park, I believe, is the school that is isolated. So given that they wanted to move some of the schools out, one of the initiatives, huge initiatives in Rosemont Valley, Apple Valley Egan, was to set up magnet schools. So if you look under Goal 1, increase racial balance within the district, several of the objectives have to do with setting up a magnet school. Again, attracting a diverse population of students. So they were doing everything from E, which was explore additional magnet schools, to enrich student learning experiences and deepen magnet school themes at the 3 current magnet schools. Then from there, they went into the strategies. So let's look at E. the strategy for, again, for racial diversification throughout the that district was to explore additional magnet schools and or programs for the purpose of integration and racial balance. So what were their strategies? Establish a process to explore the feasibility and sustainability of additional magnet schools and programs in the district. Apply for the 2010 Federal Magnet School Assistance Program. And the last bullet was to apply it at the state level.
So excuse me, Ms. Kibble. And I think it would be helpful for us to actually take some time between now and the next meeting for the members to review the plans so that we can be better prepared to ask questions. I really appreciate getting the sample because I don't think we can understand the context for how our districts are using the money without taking the time to review the plan, so I really appreciate getting it. But as I just even look at what you've just gone through and I go back to how in the last session we added the sentence, designed to close the achievement gap, we put that in statute, and then it looks to me that these objectives do not have measurable outcomes associated with them. Have you noticed that? Has there been anything done to address that change based on the current statute?
Madam Chair, that's an excellent observation. It's really the community collaboratives that work with the people they're representing in these schools that really work with that piece of it. We don't collect that information. We primarily make sure that the budget that they send us, because we can't do anything with the plans. So statutorily, we can look at the budget to make sure the budget aligns with what their goals are.
Ms. Kibble, I don't understand that. What do you mean you can't do anything with the plans?
We don't. We're not in by statute. We have the authority to look through the and approve the budget. We don't have any approval to do anything with the plans, to approve them. We can look them through them, and we make sure that the budget matches up with their goals.
So
it's the community collaborative.
So we have a program that we have said we ought to use the funds to promote the kind of interracial balance with the goal of closing the achievement gap, and that in order to qualify for the funds, you must submit a plan, but the department doesn't have any authority to address the quality of the plan?
Madam Chair, that's pretty much correct. It's the community collaborative that does. And let me add one more comment to that just to make it even more complicated. If you remember back, they don't submit plans every year. This particular plan happened to be submitted in 2008. In 2008, there wasn't the language in there for the achievement gap. So they're when you look at that, there's even a larger disconnect.
Ms. Kibble, is there any oversight role for the department in term? Well, first of all, just be clear that just on first blush, it doesn't seem like that's the appropriate role for the department to just hand out the budget without having at the same time some role in accountability for the plan. So that would be something that I think this committee will want to take some real time and discussion around making sure we fix what seems to be a gap in the language. Given that, is there also any role for the department to look at how the programs that the districts have chosen to use towards this end are working? Is there any closing the loop?
Madam Chair, that's also an excellent question. We have a lot of testimonials. A lot of the district, as you've probably heard in some of the conference committees you've had, we have the districts do surveys. If you're asking for hard facts, no, we do not have those.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, if there are any other districts that you would like copies of the plans for, please let us know and we'll make sure that we forward them to you.
Ms. Kibble, what I would be interested in, I think that committee members would appreciate, is seeing a plan from a couple of the rural districts, seeing plans from a couple of the metro districts, and then from the suburban, just so we have a sense of how those plans might differ, and then also across the various ways that one qualifies for an integration aid program. So whether you're in an you know, for example, I know the Wayzata School District is a Choice is Yours district, and that's how they participate. So that would be a different way to see a plan. But for sure, for example, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth.
Madam Chair, you would like copies of those three? And okay.
Yeah, yep. As well as a representation of some of the other types.
We'll make sure you get those. I think that'll give you a good perspective of what's happening statewide.
Thank you. And Senator Phoebe, I hate to put too much pressure on you, but you're my only and other colleague at this hearing. So, do you have any other questions with regard to this part of the information?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Not at this time.
Thank you. Okay.
So we talked a little bit about the plan. Now we get into the piece that we do have criteria that we do have oversight over. And let me back up one. If we got a plan that we really felt was out of whack or didn't really meet the intent, the staff would call the district and encourage them to change that. So I shouldn't say we don't do anything with it, but we don't have the power to regulate that. But we do have the power on the budget. So annually, even though they don't on the plan side, they only have to submit every 3 or 4 years. Annually, districts must submit a budget that is aligned with their plan, and they have to also include the UFARS codes. That is a piece that we've put in over the last 2 or 3 years, so that we can kind of measure if when they give us the UFARS codes, if they tell us they're going to use it for a specific item, when they submit their expenses, we can make sure that the dollars were spent as they said they were.
And Ms. Kibble, is there, within this packet, do I have sample budgets as well?
Madam Chair, no, I did not include any budgets, but I will make sure that you have the budgets along with the plans.
Thank you.
Yeah. In the last probably 3 years, what we did do was we started to help, because we do have the oversight on the budgets, was to look at a breakdown so that if a district didn't turn in, 100% of their expenses was going to go for administration. And where we didn't have some that wanted 100%, we did have some that it was pretty high. So our guidelines have been that 60% has to be a direct benefit to students. So that might be a district-to-district initiative. It could be something within the district, but there has to be something related to students. 30% we'd like to see for professional development for the teachers, obviously specific to integration. And then 10% can be used for administrative or indirect costs.
Ms. Kibble, could you comment on the bullet that says, under these three, that says Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth are not reviewed?
Minneapolis, yes, correct. Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth are not reviewed by the Minnesota Department of Education. They will be in the future because it's been added to the statute, but up until now they have not been.
Ms. Kibble, who was reviewing them?
Madam Chair, it was the Community Collaborative.
Can you, for the benefit of the people in the room and at the table, can you speak about who is part of the Community Collaborative?
Yes, Madam Chair. The Community Collaborative would be, obviously school district people, but would it be more than that? It would be members of the community. So different organizations that would participate. They should have parents there. It should be a diverse group. It should represent what the community looks like.
Ms. Kibble, and what was the process they used to review the budgets?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that I would be qualified right now to answer that question. As far as I would guess, first of all, that each district is probably different, but that the Community Collaborative would determine if the plan that they, because they had to approve the plan, that the budget then met the goals in the plan.
And the change that's been made now, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth are going to be reviewed in the same manner as all other school districts?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Yes, that was added to the statute last year.
Thank you. Okay.
I've included in your packet three pieces that you might find interesting that we use. The first one, it's on the left-hand side, overview of integration budget. That's kind of what we send that to the districts so that they can make sure that it's aligned with what they need to do before they submit it, the budget, to the Department of Education. It's a piece, again, that we've developed for the districts. On the right-hand side, on the blue, this is the budget worksheet that they send us. So if you look on the, if we go to the second page, they'll submit their budget by goal. So they'll take their goal from their plan, and then they'll put that in, and then the line item descriptions will be the specifics as far as what the expenses are going to be for their particular goal.
When are the school districts supposed to submit the budget? So, for example, now that you're going to be reviewing those other three districts, by when do you need to see the plans?
Last year it was April, and we haven't, we're down two staff. Both integration staff have found other jobs, or I've left the department. So we haven't set that exact date, but I'm hoping sometime in April. Because to review 116 of them and adding three large more, you're right, Madam Chair, it's going to take a while. But it'll be sometime there. The third piece is the Minnesota Integration Revenue
Excuse
Budget.
Excuse me, Ms. Kibble.
I have
now been handed the statute, and it actually does say that the district receives any revenue that it must be reviewed by, that they must submit by March 15th for its review and approval by May 15th. So they must submit it by March and approve by May is in the statute.
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate that. I had forgotten that. Yes, I think that was added last year, so thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. That's good. I'll put that on my calendar. Thank you.
And Ms. Kibble, you're doing a great job because I know you weren't even planning to be the one doing this presentation. So thank you for doing this and for stepping in. And obviously this is in your area of expertise. So it's, you know, I appreciate your knowledge. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. It's always a pleasure, though. So
okay.
It is. So the third piece that you have is the Minnesota Integration Revenue Budget Rubric. It's one piece. And that's what we use. It's just an internal piece that I thought you might find interesting to show you that we have some processes and procedures in place at the Department of Education to make sure that, again, that the budgets are aligned to the plan and that they fall within that 60-30-10%. Again, those are three pieces that we use that we either send to develop for districts or use internally.
So this rubric is interesting, and so you're saying that this is, you look at the plan, well, I don't know about the plan, the budget, because you don't review the plan, but you look at the budget across those four categories. Again, I would point to that without having some real ability to impact the plan, all of these would be almost subjectively looked at without having clear stated measurable goals as associated with a plan. So it looks like the department is moving into a direction of being interested in those goals and objectives, but still don't yet have the processes in place to accomplish that.
Madam Chair, that would be a very good way to put it. The two integration staff that I had were very knowledgeable about the plans. They had been out to the districts. They actually saw the programs live. They knew what was happening. So they did, even though we didn't have the oversight, they were well-versed in what the plans were so that when they received the budgets, they would have a good idea that those budget dollars were appropriate for that particular goal.
And how does the integration district plans work coinciding with the individual district plans?
Are you talking about, Madam Chair, are you talking about one of the EMED or the West Metro?
Mm-hmm.
They work very closely with their districts. And I know Kathy Grable's here. I don't know if you want to address any more than that, but they work very, very closely with their districts and making sure that the plan is it's cohesive.
And do those integration districts submit budgets and plans as well, or just through their own member districts?
Madam Chair, yes. They send those to us for the integration districts as well as then the districts that are part of their consortium.
Thank you.
Last piece, the integration expenditures are sent to the Department of Education, and we match them up to make sure that what they spent them on was what they said they were going to spend them on. So you asked how a success is measured. First of all, I think we've made great strides in using the 60-30-10 again, so the district can't use the money to supplant, that the money has to be used as it was intended, and that was to create integration in the districts and help the students. Do the one of the big questions that we always ask is, do the submitted expenses align with the plan? Again, it's that it's matching those up. That if the community collaborative has done the job that they're supposed to, then those goals should be aligned with the statute and to help students. So, again, our role is to make sure that the expenses are aligned with the plan.
But, Ms. Kibble, I would ask a question. What level of rigor do you use when you look at whether or not the submitted expenses align with the plan? And I ask this both from the broader perspective, but it doesn't look like that then there's an after-the-fact lining up with what actually happened versus what was said to happen, and what are the consequences of that?
Madam Chair, that's another very good question. Having signed off on the plans for the staff, I would say probably about 35% of the budgets actually have to go back to the districts, because the staff that look at them, review them, scrutinize them, feel that the items that they were in the budget don't align with what the goals were. And the districts, there are no repercussions. We allow them to realign their dollars. So let's say they put 20% in administration. We say, no, 10% can go in administration. They would have the ability then to move that additional 10% over into student activities or professional development. There are some districts that have actually, we can't come to an agreement, and there are some districts, a couple of them last year, I believe, that didn't get their full amount, didn't receive their full amount.
But at the end of the year, do you ask for an actual expenditure itemized list versus what was proposed and approved?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct. And then those expenditures are matched up with the plan. The expenses. Yes.
And do you then look at if what was spent had the impact in the plan that was supposedly, you know, set out to achieve in the first place?
Madam Chair, that's an excellent point. No.
Okay.
No, the districts may have that. And we may have pieces of that. One of the pieces that I have in here is promising practices for you in our FAQ. But no, we don't in general collect that information.
Thank you.
But I do know.
And do you have a sense of whether or not the district's actual expenditures do end up forwarding the original plans?
I would say unequivocally, absolutely. And I believe, and I can say that because of the staff that we have had in the integration area and how serious they've taken the program along with the districts. I mean, our three integration districts, WEMAP and EMED, and they're very serious about working with their districts and making sure that the initiatives can move forward for integration efforts.
Thank you.
In the future, I think there's no question that test scores can play a part. If we're supposed to be looking at the achievement gap, then the MCAs or the growth model will fit in here very nicely. But we're not looking at that right now at present. So last, and then any questions you have, the resources I'm leaving you with again are one is the frequently asked questions, kind of give you your good reading material for the weekend. I would start with this piece, because it's in a format that's pretty easy to understand. Question-answer will answer, I think, a lot of your questions, and then move on to the promising practices. And once you do that, I would suggest then you move back to the plans and the budgets that we're going to send you.
Well, I think what this committee is going to wrestle with as we do the work is that our fundamental commitment is to close the achievement gap, and that given we've had this program in place for many, many years, and I think it would be interesting to let Mr. Nauman go through the history of the way this has been funded. I didn't ask him to prepare that today, so we can do that the next time. But we have been working at this for a long time, and yet we have not made progress in closing the achievement gap. So I think that we are going to, in this committee, wrestle with how can we make sure to leverage these dollars towards that effort, and that we know that those schools that are part of this and all over the state, our focus and our spotlight is on that we want those students to achieve. And just anecdotally, I had the privilege yesterday to go into Hopkins West Junior High School after school in a program called their SOAR program. Their SOAR program is primarily students of color. It was, 99%. And these are kids that have been deemed living in poverty, high academic potential, expressed a commitment to go to college, but right now having barriers to the achievement of that. And so I got to spend an hour with them and ask them questions. What do you need? What would help you? It was fascinating what they said. You know, they didn't talk about half of them were part of the Choices Yours program and half of them lived in the district. And they didn't talk about whether or not that was a good or bad thing. They talked about they needed more help one-on-one. They talked about they actually said, we wish we could go in the summer. They said, we wished we had at least two teachers in every class so they could do more one-on-one work. They said, we wish we had teachers that looked more like us. You know, it's just fascinating. And they wanted to help. They asked if they could come to the Capitol with me and help me do my job. And I said, I need you to do my job. But so those are the kinds of things that we're going to be wrestling with.
Can they do my job
too? Well, Madam Chair.
No. Nobody can do your job. So you can't leave like Mr. McHenry.
Madam Chair, I think I can kind of go through some of this anecdotally. I think actually the integration revenue portion of this statute, Subdivision 3, is sort of a good test case of how our revenue stream tends to evolve over time. It would be a great graduate paper on how legislation evolves. Originally, when the integration revenue program was put in place, it was Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, and we just locked in a dollar figure, and it wasn't tied to pupil counts. And then I believe the next iteration, I'm going to need to get this exactly right, and I'll put together a document of this, but we then turned it into a dollar amount per pupil, which is why you have these sort of contorted-looking numbers for Duluth, St. Paul, and Minneapolis, because when we made the conversion, that was the per pupil amount that generated the same amount of revenue for each of those districts.
And so can you share with us what that dollar amount is per pupil approximately?
At this point, I'd have to go back and, okay. I mean, we can, I'll make sure I do that for the next meeting of this committee, but I'm just sort of theoretically, that's how we ended up with $206 per adjusted marginal cost pupil unit. And I think it was actually Wadhams at the time, because I don't think we had marginal cost pupil units at that point in time. So then we had to make a further adjustment to the allowances to convert them into AMCPUs when we did it. So that's what I mean. This has evolved a little bit over time. And then I think the next iteration that came along was, if you think about this program as having sort of three main buckets, you've got Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. Then you have your racially isolated districts, and then you have those districts with greater than 15% or less than 15% of protected population. Each of them has a different allowance, and those were in one case we had in the Senate bill as it moved across the floor. I think this was 2001. We added the Cascadian Amendment, which added the $129. So those districts got added in. And then there was the $92, and I can't remember the exact time frame of that, but I'll make sure that we get that for the next time around, of when that was added. So the legislature has spoken in a variety of different ways to generate additional revenue for different classes of districts. And I see Mr. Graffall in the back of the room. He's going to remember that in 2001, what he and I have talked about as a pound of flesh was taken out of Minneapolis, where in order to meet a legislative compromise, the total dollar figure for Minneapolis was reduced down to the same level that you had in St. Paul. So it's $445 times their AMCPUs. But then a few years later, Minneapolis was allowed to levy back the amount of dollars that they lost at that point. And the other final permutation that I will offer, and again, we'll get a formal timeline on this for the next time, is that the legislature, to meet its aid and levy targets, has adjusted the aid levy split over time. So you'll notice that right now, under the presentation that was talked about earlier, we're at about a 70-30 split. But if you look at subdivision 4 in the language, and that language is actually in the bill, you can see that over time, back in 2003, it was 37% levy, and in 2004, it was 23% levy, and then from fiscal 2005 and later, it's been at 30%. So because this committee or the full committee struggles with a balance of aid and levy, this has been one of those programs that's been, frankly, adjusted to accomplish legislative targets.
Mr. Nauman, when you say a 70-30 split, would that mean that if there was a school district that was off the formula, that was a levy school district, would theirs be as high as 100% and another school district would be?
Madam Chair, I sort of glossed over this, but if you consider that the dollar figures that I talked about at the beginning in terms of the $92, $129, that's the revenue that a school district is eligible to receive. And in the case of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, it's a different amount. Setting aside Minneapolis's levy back for the moment, whatever that revenue amount is, 30% of it comes from the levy and the 70% comes from state aid.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Nauman, this is the first time that I understood that Minneapolis was able to levy back to that amount, because I, in my own mind, assumed that Minneapolis and St. Paul were at the equal amount on a per-pupil basis. So do you suspect that because of that new levy ability that now, in fact, Minneapolis has a different amount per pupil?
Well, if you take a look at – I'm not sure if you have a chance to look at this document that's in the packet that was provided by the department. It's just the 124D 86. It's pretty clear. You can see it right there in subdivision 3. But the first thing it sets forth is Duluth gets $206 times its units. St. Paul is $445. And you see Minneapolis is $445. But then there's that additional language.
35.
So the amount for the case of Minneapolis would be the 445, and that's the amount that split 70-30. Mm-hmm. And then you've got this additional $35, which isn't split. It's 100% levy. So Minneapolis has got this additional calculation that you have to make.
And then it's my understanding that the remainder have the 129.
Well, Madam Chair, for those districts that have in excess of 15% of the protected population, they're at 129. And for those that are required to implement a plan that are less than 15%, then you're at $92. Mm. And you can see that language slops onto the last page of the.
Gotcha. That is a complicated formula, my.
And Madam Chair, this is actually one of the critiques that the legislative auditor highlighted in its report, stating that there are some classes of districts that get certain amounts or other classes of districts get another amount, and then there are those three districts that are specifically spelled out. And my initial reaction when I read that was, well, of course, that's what the legislature has said over time with various different bills. So the bill, the legislative finding, or the auditor's finding, is consistent with what the legislature has actually said. But it might be valuable for the legislature to actually think about that. Is this in fact what you want to have happen?
Thank you, Mr. Nauman. I think that is why we're around the table and why we have expressed interest in that. We would like to think about it and discuss it and have transparency with regard to it and ask the tough questions, like what is it we're trying to accomplish. And I will also remind the people in the room that we had the demographer come and speak to us last session, who talked about how our state is changing and how, in a very short order, you know, the amount of diversity in our school districts will become the majority. And so for us to have a formula that's based on some pretty old thinking might not be in our best interest. We might want to revisit, with our central focus being how do we close the achievement gap? What can we provide our school districts with, making sure that they are given all the tools in the toolbox towards that. So thank you for being here, and I think there's been good food for thought, and we look forward to this work.
Madam Chair, members of the community, thank you very much.
And are there, I know I didn't ask for testifiers here today, but as with any public hearing, if there's anybody who would like to come forward.
There's a gentleman in the back behind the pillar.
Please, sir. Sir, I'm assuming you're moving forward to testify?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you would please state your name for the record.
Sure. Thank you very much. My name is Roger Banks. I'm the research and policy analyst for the State Council on Black Minnesotans. And I really thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Please proceed.
I really didn't come here prepared to testify, but listening to some of the testimony in the discussion, I can't help but make some comments. And one of them has to do with it is not either or in this effort. That is, it's not only achievement gap, but you can't achieve and reduce the achievement gap unless you have a very good, you know, integrative plan, an integration plan. And so they have to go hand in hand. More importantly, I think that it's really critical that the Senate take steps and the House take steps to create a more effective evaluation mechanism for this particular program, because it's been lacking. 3 years ago at McNamara alumni site at the university, this issue was broached with at a state conference on this issue. And we were assured that the particulars, organizations, school districts, et cetera, were involved in creating evaluative mechanisms. But we've not seen anything yet. And in many respects, that's because the larger school districts like Duluth and Minneapolis and St. Paul are not really required to do an evaluation. They're required to permit to submit a report. There's a significant difference, okay? Now, what we're after essentially is the understanding that this is a statewide program, and as such, there should be some state goals specified. And if it's if they're associated with the achievement gap, then it should be, you know, those kind of things. And there should also be programmatic evaluations. That is, that there's a two-tiered system that gets at the impact of this particular dollars, you know, that are being allocated for this particular purpose, making sure that everybody is satisfied and we have some sense of accountability and efficacy on the part of those individuals performing this particular task. Now, we're very much concerned about the issue of equity and concerned about the issue of accountability. That is the Council of Black Minnesotans. We're very much concerned that this is the type of program that needs to be pursued, but it's the type of program that also needs some significant revisions. And that was pointed out in the auditor's report. And it's interesting to note that very few, if any, of the recommendations made by the state auditor, the state legislative auditor, have been addressed. And it seems to me that's a little pacificity, if you know what I mean, both in terms of the legislature, which really didn't provide a clear purpose for the piece of legislation. We need clarity of purpose. And nor did it do anything relative to the kinds of changes that were recommended relative to the role of the Department of Education. Because it's really critical that they have authority over admitting agencies to participate in this program. Right now, they don't, or at least they didn't, you know, previously. And there, while there have been some significant changes, i.e. the focus on academic performance and the achievement gap, which I call an opportunities gap because of the lack, put it this way, the systematic disinvestment in schools that have high populations of color in American Indians. Okay? So we need to focus certainly on that particular aspect, but we also need to focus on the whole issue of integration, because you're not going to get that academic performance unless you have at least an understanding of what the hell integration is supposed to be. Now, one of the major problems that I see in this whole endeavor is that funds from this program have been devoted solely to, for the most part, the kids, the students in the program. To me, those kids don't pose much of a barrier or a sense of resistance relative to the issue of education, of segregation in education, okay, or the issue of integration. Those kids aren't per se racist. But what you find is that since the inception of this particular program, there have been certain school districts like Osseo and Bloomington that have become more and more segregated. And it's not because of the kids. It's because of the actions of the boards of education, the school boards, their superintendents that have, for the most part, redesigned the attendance districts so that you have more or less a different type of school that you want to go to. In some instances, the preservation of what I call all-white schools and the more colorful school districts. You know, you know what I mean.
So I do.
The whole thing about this is that the council is more than willing, and we've offered when the first report came out, when it was reported to the legislature by the legislative auditor's office, we offered Commissioner Seagram our assistance, the Council of Black Minnesotans, to assist in two things: setting up an evaluation mechanism, and really providing a link between the Department of Education and the Black community relative to the efforts of this program, the goals of this program, the successes and the failures of this particular program, because that's the kind of clarity that's needed. That's the kind of enforcement and knowledge that we need in our communities. A lot of communities have little or no knowledge about all the millions of dollars, i.e., that have been expended in this particular area, or the successes that they've had, or the lack of success that they've had. But the whole thing about this is that we offer our assistance in terms of working with the Department of Education and with the legislature. I've made this offer in two hearings just within the last week. The hearing over in North High at with Representative Newton and Representative Brown as the co-chairs of the hearing, and at another location in St. Paul. So we're very serious about this because we feel that we cannot afford to lose this kind of movement. At least,
well, Mr. Banks, I can tell you that I appreciate your offer, and we will reach out to you. And that's why we've convened the subcommittee, because we don't think that we have acted strongly enough to the findings of the legislative auditor. And you could tell from the tone of the questions that, in particular, we're concerned about that there is not a strong role for the department, and that there are not evaluative tools, and that there really must be. And I take very seriously your first charge, which is it cannot be either or, and so we will make sure to utilize all of you in the community so that we don't have it be an either or.
Well, I thank you very much.
Thank you for coming forward.
Right. My pleasure.
Yes. Welcome. Please state your name for the record. And those of you who are here who didn't plan to testify, there will be opportunities. So, thank you.
My name is Ron Hagland, and I direct the Office of Education Equity for Duluth. And I think, even though I didn't come prepared to offer comment, I'm thinking about several things I would like to say that would kind of fall into two categories.
I'm sorry.
First is really kind of a personal level. My background is social work for years, and then almost 15 years as a human resource executive. And while I was working in HR across the country, including Minnesota, I had the opportunity to hire a lot of people who had high school degrees but were functionally illiterate. So I was really kind of coaxed out of retirement And that fact was one of my motivators. And it didn't make any difference what particular race those individuals were that were functionally illiterate. They were in a one-down position in the workforce. And that was one of my key concerns for taking the position in Duluth. The second thing I'd like to say is that whenever I get into a group like this and with this topic, I'm reminded of my sister, who was a teacher for almost 30 years. She taught places like Red Lake and Net Lake and South Chicago, where she finished up after about 10 years of teaching. But I was probably her first student. Literally, she would take me behind the barn where we had some huge stones, and she would sit me up on the rock, and she said, I don't want you going to school sounding like some dumb Indian. We're going to play English. And she taught me words and had me try to pronounce, which I think probably at that point was a real trick with no front teeth. But she was a teacher from day one. And she really nurtured in me a love of school and a love of learning. And she was, in fact, one of my key role models.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. And one of the English words I've really bumped into in the last year since I've been in this position, not just within Duluth, but throughout the state and some of the national events I've attended, is the term counterintuitive. Now, I've come to conclude that the word counterintuitive means one of several things. When it's referred to an activity that someone is engaged in, it suggests that the activity is unproductive or unethical, but we're going to do it anyway, or worst case scenario, dishonest. Okay? And in this position, I bumped into all of that assumed definition in varying degrees in different quarters. When we start talking about the Integration Revenue Program, I really get concerned when I listen to this. And maybe that's the old social worker in me, you know. But I look at the Integration Revenue Program as having, I've got teenage boys, and I don't know why, but they were more interesting to raise than my daughter, who is pretty much a straight arrow. But I wouldn't have given them the keys to my car without first having taught them how to drive. And in a way, that's what this whole Integration Revenue Program process looks like to me as a recent arrival. Okay? Minnesota and Duluth have different WADMs. 445 for Minneapolis, St. Paul each, and Duluth has $210 per student in the district. Now, I don't know if at some point in time somebody thought our needs were less than Minneapolis and St. Paul's, or heaven forbid there was a political process involved that came up with those figures, but that's where we're at. I do know that of our dollars in Duluth, which I can speak to, that 70% comes from the state and 30% is raised through the commitment of the local community to the effort, and that makes up our total $206 per student. That's how it shapes out for us. Can't talk about anybody.
Yep, Mr. Nauman said that is how it is all over the state.
Right, yeah. If they choose to implement the maximum levy. They don't have to implement any levy, but if they choose, they can go up to 30%. There's a couple of points I want to make, and with all due respect to Gloria.
Please, with all due respect, do be brief, because we have spent more time today than we had planned to, so thank you.
Right. 10, 60, 30, brand new as of this year for all of the districts. That means not just 10%, but up to 10% for administration. And we have consistently in Duluth State at about 5.5%. A minimum of 60%, not a mandated 60% for direct student services, and up to 30% for staff development, up to This year, for the first time, we're committing 7.5%. It's like trying to turn a battleship. But Minnesota, in all of the history here, Duluth, Minneapolis, St. Paul, we were grandparented into this process. Now, a lot of people are hearing, and I hear this at other meetings for integration specialists, okay, we're going to redistribute the formula. We're going to change the formula. To me, from my perspective, it's like throwing scraps on the table to a lot of hungry critters who are going to jump on this and divide it. The flip side of that is now you have added closing the achievement gap to the legislation, and whether you do the race to the top scenario that would contribute dollars to that effort, here is a window of opportunity to say, ask the question, what do we really need to do in order to make sure this happens, and we do in fact close the achievement gap, or we're just going to redistribute the current level of funding and let the groups divide it among themselves. There's a lot more I will say on these on all of this later, but my last point, American Indians are a unique political and legal entity. It's not the basis of parent advisory committees or anything that makes that distinction. There is federal dollars that come into the Minnesota Indian Education Act. There is legislation. With regard to the integration dollars, schools cannot be considered racially isolated if American Indians elect to send their children to those schools. Okay? Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that American Indians are excluded from receiving the benefits of that funding.
Thank you.
Way, shape, or form. Thank you.
Thank you. Point taken, and I appreciate you speaking. Okay. Well, I think it's been an illuminating hearing, and I can assure you that the members who are missing will get this information. Senator Phoebe, myself, and the staff will make sure. And all of you who are here, thank you for staying, and thank you for the department for preparing and delivering the presentation. Subcommittee on Integration Aid is adjourned.
For your information, apparently, he thinks that I said.